Sunstone's Brian Buchanan and Lindsay Hanson Park bring you this limited mini-series, The History of Mormon History. Welcome to Deseret Dramas Season 2.
In Chapter 2, a massive project wraps. Books are published, but Chapter 14 is missing. All this and more in Chapter 2. Chapter 2. Mama, don't let your histories grow up to be published. The Saga of History of the Church.
In late 1857, Leo Hawkins, a scribe working in the historian's office, finished copying the account of the August 8, 1844 meeting into the sixth and final ledger of a massive project begun 20 years earlier. I know he was a church employee and all, but I hope he screamed out, "Hot damn!" and ran out into the street to stick pole or some other 19th century form of escapism, because he and all of his colleagues deserved it. Seriously, this was work.
When we left you last time, we'd been discussing the monumental project to finally write Joseph Smith's history. 2,400 pages later, it was done. George A. Smith and Wilford Woodruff, the church historians, published an announcement in the Deseret News. This was fair. It was truly a moment worthy of celebrating. However, the Leo Hawkinses and the Jonathan Grimshaws of the world, scribes, were the ones who really should have had their names there, too. Anyone who writes several hundred ledger-sized pages with a quill and ink deserves public adulation. Don't at me here. All right, you know the drill. Let's hear their statement, and then let's put on our analyzing hat. Quote,
"The history of Joseph Smith is now before the world, and we are satisfied that a history more correct in its details than this was never published. To have it strictly correct, the greatest possible pains have been taken by the historians and clerks engaged in the work. They were ear and eyewitnesses of nearly all the transactions recorded in this history, most of which were reported as they transpired, and where they were not personally present, they have had access to those who were."
Okay, first point. A history more correct in its detail than this was never published. George and Wilford, if you want to come back from the dead and add the word Mormon, sure. True, no better Mormon history had ever been published. I'm not saying they didn't take the greatest possible pains. They say that they did. Part of the issue is that this history at the time looked very different than it does now. Like so many other fields, the nuts and bolts of how history is done has improved dramatically. We now rely on what we call scientific history, documentary history. It's not without its problems, but it's the best we've got. But another aspect of this deals with the claim that the historians and scribes were there for most of the history, quote, "most of which were reported as they transpired." No, pump the brakes there just a bit. A lot absolutely was not reported at the time, and the idea that if it wasn't, since George and Wilford were there, they could just seamlessly fill in the gaps. Yeah, memories aren't quite that awesome. Try remembering an event from 10 or 20 years ago and see how good you are. If you're a fan of the podcast Serial, remember when Sarah Koenig tried to get teenagers to recall events that had happened just a few weeks earlier and they couldn't? It's because our memories are consistently not as cool as we think they are.
And whatever, dudes wrote 2,400 pages of history, good on them. But the point where they stopped the narrative is very significant. The August 8th, 1844 meeting is where, from an LDS perspective, Brigham Young decisively and legitimately declared his place as the successor to Joseph Smith. For everyone else, and LDS folks have to be reminded frequently, this is not a small group of people. The situation was definitely not so definite. We will eventually get to that back on our regular day, or more accurately, night job, the Sunstone History Podcast. So now what? They're done. Scribes can just stick pull out in the streets all day long, free and easy. No dice, Leo Hawkins and company.
The historian's office had figured it out, and you would hope so, after killing off three scribes and filling up six innocent ledgers over 20 years. The process was now a science. take the documents and craft a single narrative of the president of the church and copy it into the ledger. The guys in the 1850s might have been tempted to look down at their predecessors for being slow and sketchy. Hey, when you aren't dying of malaria and moving from state to state, it's objectively easier to write history. The historian's office became a machine cranking out fairly consistent mountains of history.
For the next 20 years, pioneer scribes sang as they wrote. They picked up in August 1844 and copied like demons until they caught up to the present, and then they just kept going. So down to April 1880, ledger after ledger was filled with this narrative history that was based on the contemporary documents. And if you're guilty of being a nerdy Mormon book person like me, you're thinking in your head, wait a minute, you hear history of the church used as a source all the time, but that's just for the Joseph Smith era. What's this business about it continuing to be written until 1880? Well, just like so many other aspects of LDS history and theology, there is a very clear demarcation in June 1844. You have Joseph Smith, then there's everything else. No one talks about the Prophet Wilford or the Prophet Harold. History follows this system of classification. They printed Joseph Smith history, on two continents no less. They started to do this with Brigham Young's history, but it didn't last very long.
While all this labor, time, and ink was expended on writing manuscript history, similar publishing efforts weren't part of the program. Even Joseph Smith's history was a newspaper or periodically only thing. Unless you wanted to devote a space in your log cabin for a giant stack of the Times and Seasons in the Desert News, or the Millennial Star if you lived on the moors in England, it just wasn't accessible. With all the anti-polygamy craziness of the 1880s, publishing history wasn't exactly high on the priority list. Once the manifesto was issued in 1890, putting a complete and total stop to polygamy, they could think about other things. Hopefully you realize I'm joking about the manifesto. If not, then you'll enjoy it even more in the other podcast when we talk about how badly that is not the case. But the post-manifesto era was different, and LDS church leaders started talking about what to do with their history.
First Presidency counselor George Q. Cannon was the main force that got the ball rolling again. All the momentum they had built up had disappeared, and he knew it. In 1895, he started getting after the historian's office staff for sucking at their job. Cannon was usually pretty blunt, and that was the case here. He noted in his diary, quote,
"I have felt for years that our historian's office was in a bad shape, and that it was doing but little towards preserving or compiling history, the method of conducting it being loose and unliterary," close quote.
And then, the whole staff had to come meet with the First Presidency and hear about it again. But that history ball was heavy, man. It was hard to get rolling again. 5 years went by with pretty much no change to the status quo.
In May of 1900, things started shaking. George Buchanan describes a meeting where B.H. Roberts was proposed to finally publish Joseph Smith's history in book form. But Roberts was no cheap painted historian of the night. He apparently asked for $2,500 a year. If you're like Lucille Bluth and think one banana costs $10, let me give you a point of reference. This would be about 80 grand today. Roberts was already getting about 40 grand a year as one of the first counselors of the 70. Now, that's no Fortune 500 salary, but geez, give me 80 grand a year to just write history and you have a deal, sir. The committee told Beach to take a historical hike. In his very common false modesty way of writing in his journal, George Q. Cannon said he told the committee if he were a younger man, he would probably have done it. The way he tells it, everyone then practically begged him to do it.
Old modest George got some other tasks cleared, and a few months later, he's ready to do some history. With his son, John Q., as his assistant, and if you want to hear about a fascinating earlier fiasco in his life dealing with, you guessed it, polygamy, Lindsay has a really great Year of Polygamy episode that involves him, George Q. got down to work. They actually got about 100 pages typeset and printed. Their process was they would take this serialized history that had been printed in the Millennial Star, which was helpfully collected by that expensive sucker B.H. Roberts, and then they would compare it against the manuscript version. And honestly, George Q. was no slouch. Listen to his approach, quote,
"In order to have as correct a version of the history of the church as possible, and especially the Revelations, I have adopted the plan of going to the oldest documents we have and comparing them with that which has been published. I find discrepancies occasionally. I intend to make what we now publish as correct as possible.
Close quote. Attaboy, George. I can feel it. Books are going to be published soon. Wait, why do I hear the Twilight Zone theme in the background?
Just 6 months after starting to work on the history, Cannon died unexpectedly in California. He was 74, so not young, but as vigorous as he always was, it was a shock. Great, back to square one. Not much time passed, though. Just 6 weeks after Cannon's death, Beach Roberts was engaged to get the history ready for publication. No details on whether he wanted 80K this time around. The team, headed by B.H. Roberts, along with wingman, OCD Danish detail man Andrew Jensen, believer in reincarnation Orson F. Whitney, and A. Milton Musser, father of our guy Joseph Musser, father of Mormon fundamentalism, all of whom had been called as assistant church historians, worked quick. By August 1902, a little more than a year after the work began, the Deseret News published an ad looking for canvassers who would pound the pavement and sell copies of the first volume. Doesn't that sound deliciously vintage? Who doesn't want to be a canvasser?
All right, start your engines, canvassers, because books were done a month later. A massive ad in the Deseret News that makes my nerdy book-loving heart so glad proclaimed that the books would be ready the next day. You could choose from a hardback at $1.50, two different kinds of partial leather at $2.50, or even full leather binding with gilt edges for the princely sum of $4. Even though they printed quite a few books, especially the hardbacks, they weren't exactly cheap. So in current dollars, prices ranged from about $45 for the hardback to $120 for the full leather. Not cheap. Anyone is welcome to rev their DeLorean up to 88 miles an hour and go back and buy me one of those full leather copies. Seriously, like I will happily reimburse you the $4. They rarely turn up these days and are definitely a collector's item.
Subsequent volumes came out pretty much like clockwork. 1904, 1905, 1908, 1909, and 1912, completing the history up to the death of Joseph Smith. During their work, they had to confront all sorts of issues. We get a few hints of the kinds of discussions they had at the office. Anton Lund, who, as church historian, was the boss man, noted one day in his journal, quote, "In the revelation to Oliver Cowdery in May of 1829, Brother Robert said that the gift which the Lord says he has in his hand meant a divining stick which was like Aaron's rod. It is said Brother Phineas Young got it from him and gave it to President Brigham Young, who had it with him when he arrived in the valley, and that it was with that stick that he pointed out where the temple should be built." End quote. Another one deals with the first vision. In the official 1839 version, it was Joseph Smith describing his thinking about all of churches. Quote, "At this time, it had never entered into my heart that they were all wrong." In the margin of his collections, B.H. Roberts wrote that it contradicted the Wentworth letter. Eagle Eye historian in front of the podcast, Dan Vogel, notes that it actually doesn't, but the same 1839 account earlier has Joseph Smith wondering if they were, quote, all wrong together. Quick side note here, Truman Madsen wrote a biography of B.H. Roberts, and his discussion of handling the churches are all wrong episode gets basically everything wrong. Sorry, all missionaries who listen to the Joseph Smith tapes, but anytime Truman Madsen starts with quoting something or, you know, trying to do history, just assume you'll suck at it. Again, I'm sorry for your loss, missionaries.
B.H. Roberts periodically wrote letters to the First Presidency with his suggestions that are very interesting. In one case, he argued that Joseph Smith was probably not the author of an article attributed to him and suggested they leave it out, and they approved of his idea. But my favorite is when Roberts crapped all over the long, wonky explanation of how Mormon actually means more good. You remember this, right? Good in Egyptian is mon, and with the addition of more, M-O-R-E, or the contraction, M-O-R, we have the word Mormon, which means literally more good. Yuck. B.H. had figured out W.W. Phelps had probably written it, not Joseph Smith, and it was, quote, "based on inaccurate premises and was offensively pedantic," close quote. Yep and yep. They left it out.
the very best controversy of all is the mystery of the missing chapter 14. It was a perfect case for Joe and Frank Hardy to take on. In 1912, folks noticed the ad in the Improvement Era announcing that the sixth and final volume of the History of the Church was ready, and, as the ad not so subtly directed, every family should have a complete set. Because you weren't some crappy apostate, you walked down to Desert News Bookstore, plunked down your $4, and took your awesome, gilt-edged book home to read. On page 301, you read that, quote, President Joseph Smith delivered a discourse between 20,000 saints, being the funeral sermon of Elder King Follett. Ah, yes, the famous King Follett discourse. So you turned to page 302. Only it wasn't 302, it was 318.
You said the worst word you were allowed by law at that point, darn. And then your wife got really sad because you were setting such a bad example for the children. You had just spent four hard-earned dollars that you got working at your job scooping horse crap out of the streets of Salt Lake City so that the few weirdos who owned motor carriages could drive through. Now your book is missing pages. So you text your friend who had come with you to buy his copy. No, of course you didn't. You put your full Prince Albert suit back on, grabbed your out-of-style top hat made of beaver pelt, and walked over to his house like a normal person. Sure enough, he just discovered that his copy was missing pages. By Jove, it's a conspiracy. So the two of you walked back to the Deseret News bookstores to give the clerk a taste of your broadsword. When you tell him that both of you want to return your sucky, defective books, the clerk sheepishly tells you that actually, every copy is missing those pages, and no, it wasn't a mistake.
Right now, if you look at the scan of this volume on archive.com, there's an inserted note that says, please note that the pagination in this volume jumps from page 301 to page 318. This is a printing error only. There are no missing pages. Nice try, archivers. There are missing pages, obviously, but it wasn't a printing error. This was a deliberate move, one made by none other than the prophet himself, Joseph F. Smith.
Remember the F.
He prophetically yeeted the entire chapter. Earlier in the year, the First Presidency had sent letters to mission presidents because the King Follett sermon had been printed in the Liahona, the mission periodical. They were told, do not print or circulate any more the King Follett sermon without hearing from us. In a follow-up letter, they added, when the sermon was first published, it did not receive the revision of the sanction of the prophet Joseph, who preached it, and it was reported from the impressions obtained by four different persons who heard it, neither of whom was a shorthand writer. Okay, boomer prophet, hopefully someone got to tell him that this also applied to, oh, I don't know, every single other report of Joseph Smith's sermons in existence.
And who might have been responsible for publishing it in the Liahona? Mr. B.H., of course. It was quite the production, with lots of footnotes. Footnotes that Joseph F. Smith hated. Joseph F., remember the F., lectured the mission presidents that B.H.'s crappy footnotes, quote,
introduced ideas not warranted by the text, which state plainly that the original report is evidently incorrect in some particulars. Such a doubtful production, we think it is not proper to publish as authentic.
Close quote. Guess who just happens to be walking the beach in California and is not in the historian's office at this point? Anton Lund, Mr. Bossman of the History Project, who also happens to be Joseph F. Smith's first counselor. Given how clearly irritated Joseph F. was about this, I imagine there may have been some awkward moments in the office later when it came up. This was so late in the publishing game that they had to just go ahead and yeet them pages. Remember, this is an era before InDesign and print-on-demand. Dudes had to physically typeset and print pages, gather them, and bind them. Chapter 14 would just have to go missing.
Okay, kids, gather round because it's now story time. T. Edgar Lyon, a longtime BYU and Institute guy, told a fascinating tale about the aftermath. Apparently, his father, David Lyon, ran magazine printing in Salt Lake City. I will now use my best elementary school library storytelling voice. One day, as nearly as I can figure out, it must have been the summer of 1913, when I was somewhat around 10 years of age, I was sitting at the table, when a rather stocky man with a dark mustache came in. My father turned and said, "What can I do for you, B.H.?" And the reply was, "Dave,
I want you to print a pamphlet for me. He handed him a manuscript of the King Follett Discourse. He said, I completed reading the page proofs of Volume 6 of the History of the Church. The book went to press. Shortly before it was put on sale, I received a call to tour the mission, and I was gone for 3 months or so. When I returned, I found on my desk a leather-bound copy with my name stamped in gold on the 6th volume. I flipped it open and put it on the shelf. A Sunday or two later, I was speaking at state conference, and I referred to the King Follett Discourse. Someone came up and asked me if it were in print, and I said, of course it is. Well, where? It's the 6th volume of the documentary history. Roberts went on to say that during afternoon session of conference, the man handed President Roberts the book and said, I have looked through it and I can't find it. Roberts replied, I know it's there because I wrote it. He turned to the place where it should have been, but the sermon wasn't there. 16 pages had been left out of the book. Well, Brother Roberts said when he got back in Salt Lake City, he went to the bookstores and looked at the copies. The King Follett Discourse was not in them. When he asked what happened, he learned that some of the brethren were not persuaded that the King Follett Discourse was authentic. Now, I don't know what the brethren meant in those days, but Brother Roberts did, and he said that he felt very unhappy about it. David, I want you to print 10,000 copies of this sermon, and please hurry it through the press. I want to take them to the Stake and Mission Conference and give one to every member of the Stake Presidencies and High Councils and Bishoprics and Presidents of the Missions and the Branches. I'll give this wider circulation than the book will ever get.
I absolutely love this story. B.H. was never shy about doing what he thought B.H. should do. But the missing chapter kept on causing problems. Another entertaining story comes from a grad student who was part of a study group at Stanford with a bunch of returned missionaries. Of course, they had to tackle
deep doctrine.
That was a very solemn and impressive tone, of course, like the nature of deity. So they wanted to check something in the King Follett Discourse, and somebody said, well, it's in History of the Church. Yeah, it wasn't. It was in the table of contents, though. With their curiosity piqued, they did what everyone did at that time, write a letter to Joseph Fielding Smith, a.k.a. Grouchy Mormon Google. Joseph Fielding, remember the Fielding, apparently wrote back, quote,
The King Follett Discourse was not published in the History of the Church because President Joseph F. Smith did not want it included,
close quote. Suck it, B.H.
Suck it, B.H. With the mystery of the missing Chapter 14 in the bag, thanks, Hardy Boys, History of the Church was done. Until, for some reason, 20 years later, B.H. Roberts decided it needed a 7th volume covering the period between Joseph Smith's death and when Brigham Young was officially ordained president of the church at the end of 1847. As an interesting side note, a minimally revised second edition came out in 1948. This time, the King Follett Discourse was reinstated as Chapter 14. Interestingly, the president of the church at that point, George Albert Smith, had expressed the same kind of suspicion toward it earlier that Joseph F. Smith had. This blue 7-volume set would sit on the bookshelves of many Mormon homes, including my own. A much smaller percentage of the sets were actually read, but that's another discussion. It became the source. Every secondary history and biography from that point on leaned heavily on it. When a new edition of the Doctrine and Covenants was repaired in 1921, the section headings for the revelations referred to readers to History of the Church for the historical context, giving it quasi-canonical status. It didn't help that part of the uber-long title was History of Joseph Smith the Prophet by himself. You, gentle listeners, know by now that's not quite the case.
Slowly, as historians started to reassess History of the Church, a feeling arose that we needed to be more careful of how we used it. As folks like Dean Jesse and others began to move the field of Mormon history into a more academic climate, the shortcomings of this source were analyzed. Now, in fairness, we have to remember to be careful about looking at things through our presentist glasses. At the risk of repeating ourselves, we should keep in mind Robert's work was created in a time of very different historiography. As one study of early histories of the U.S. found, quote,
The message of original sources had been distorted by a rhetorical literary form, an inordinate cultural bias, and undependable editorial procedures,
close quote. So, it wasn't really out of the ordinary. Even trained historians, which B.H. Roberts was admittedly not, did things in a way that modern historians wag their finger at. So we've reached a point that friend of the podcast, Ben Park, suggested a contract that historians should agree to. Quote,
I, insert your name, promise to never rely, quote, or reference B.H. Roberts' History of the Church, except for studying B.H. Roberts specifically, or Mormon historical writing in general. So, we're exempt here. I acknowledge the numerous problems with these volumes, the availability of more reliable sources, and confess that any use of the history of the church from this point on is a result of my own scholarly laziness. I understand that any reliance on the history of the church after this point will result in numerous scoffing, critiques, and in general, academic weeping, wailing, and gnashing of teeth.
R.I.P. History of the Church. You had a good run, kid.
Pretty much every first-time author is downright giddy to have a book published. Roberts had published 20 books by this point. 20. And that's not even counting the 7 volumes of the History of the Church. His fancy Waterman fountain pen must have been tired. No way he was going to write more history. What's that? He would? 6 more volumes? Guy's a masochist. Next time, in Chapter 3.
This series was written by Brian Buchanan, co-hosted by Lindsay Hansen Park, co-produced by Sunstone and Laurel Smith Steele. If you like what you hear, please consider a donation at sunstone.org.